So I call our meeting to order for this month of September 2017. And I would like our commissioners, it's good to see everyone. Someone said to me before, how was the summer? I said, did it happen yet? But I hope everyone had a very good summer. And for those of us who are in this special time of the Jewish year between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, a good year. Thanks to everyone for the year. So starting with right down there, we'll introduce ourselves and then we'll go to our next part of our agenda. So let's just say hi.
Hi, just nice to chair the health committee.
Oh, but use your microphones, okay?
Sorry, I'm Dr. Gus Mantillo, Chair of the Health Committee.
Michelle Del Monte.
Mark Epstein, and I'm an attorney, and I'm from Western Southern.
Greetings, Dr. Hafiz Rahman, and it's also the Islamic New Year at the same time as the Jewish New Year. They coincided. So Happy New Year to everybody.
And we're glad to see you back from your summer of recovery, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, so thank God. That's no good.
Good evening, Dr. Walker Bilbrey, the Affirmative Action Officer at Southern Community College.
Good evening, I'm Carolyn Seabody, and I'm a co-chair of the Administration of Justice Committee, responsible for the East End.
Gary Maher, the Education Committee.
Rabbi Steve Moss, Chair.
Good evening, Linda Perdomo-Mayola. I'm Vice Chair. He's the Chair, I'm the Vice Chair. And I am actually the Administrative Chair for all committees that are held under the Human Rights Commission.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Dawn Lott. I'm the Executive Director of the Suffolk County Human Rights Commission, and welcome.
Good evening, Yuan Wong. Education Committee as well, and...
Hey, good evening, I'm Louis Rodriguez, I'm a practicing attorney, special prosecutor for Village of Hempstead.
What I'd like to do is to welcome our presiding officer of this room of our county's legislature, Dwayne Gregory, for a few words. Welcome. And actually, in my, whatever it is, 25 years of being a chair, this is the first time that a presiding officer has actually addressed us. And that is very special and wonderful, but also indicates the deep abiding devotion and dedication to the issues that we are concerned about here at the Human Rights Commission, and thereby, I know, the legislature and our county. So I thank you, presiding officer, for all the work that you do for your specific community that you represent, but also for all of us in doing the work that you do each and every day. So thank you very much. God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Rabbi Moss. I feel like I owe you a gratuity for such the kind words. No, it's a pleasure to call you a friend and to have known you for so many years. And I want to thank all of you for all the work that you do for our county. I know it's a sacrifice, and it's certainly a commitment. So I want to thank you and all the members of the commission, your executive director. She's out there working hard. I just was with her in Riverhead last week. So she's, you know, from the west to the east. So she's representing the commission well. But I did want the opportunity to come before you tonight just to say a few words. I know you're having a hearing, public hearing on DACA. And so I thank you for the opportunity. Again, I'm presiding officer Dwayne Gregory. I'd like to welcome you to the William H. Rogers Legislative Building. This is where our legislature, your legislature, holds the majority of its public meetings. I offer my special thanks to the Suffolk County Human Rights Commission for dedicating a portion of this evening's meeting to discussing the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program. It's an important topic that needs to be in the spotlight, and I'm grateful that the commission is giving it the time that it merits. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, was put in place to protect one of our most vulnerable and innocent populations, undocumented immigrants who came here as children. The policy gives work permits and protection from deportation to to these young children, these young people, excuse me, who are going to school and who have clean criminal records. This allows them to be productive members of society and live their lives free from fear. The Trump administration has announced that it is officially rescinding the DACA program. The U.S. government is not accepting new applications and will stop renewal applications on October 5th, Thursday of next week. This will affect some 690,000 unauthorized immigrants currently enrolled in the program who will retain their benefits for a total 2 years. Suffolk County is rich with diversity and culture. Nurtured by our immigrant community, we stand on values of respect for others, inclusiveness of our differences, and support of those in need. In my personal opinion, repealing this program is in direct opposition to these values. The ramifications of ending this policy could be devastating to a young person forced to move to a country completely foreign to them when they know in their heart they belong here. When we protect the innocent, which includes all children, regardless of their immigration status, we speak to the heart of what we value as a nation. Tonight is about educating ourselves and hearing firsthand from DACA recipients, leaders, and benefactors. Again, my sincere thanks to the Human Rights Commission for giving this program a platform this evening, and thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. Does anyone want to offer any comments? Thank you very much. And please say welcome to stay. Hope you will. And by the way, Mr. Gregory, what we're going to do is, as we had done about 6 months ago or so, when we had a similar open mic, so to speak, for DACA Dreamers, is that what we hear tonight is being recorded, obviously, and then we actually burn CDs and mail them out, I believe. I hope you got a copy, the legislators, government, as well as our representatives in Washington and state, to hear the testimonies. So those who speak before us have some sense that what they are sharing with us is not just for these walls and our ears, but rather hopefully for the ears of those who could, God willing, make a difference. So thanks. Okay, consent agenda, we need to approve the minutes from, June? Was it June? Yeah, June, wow. So anyway, anyone have any
thoughts? Move to approve.
Thank you. Second? Michelle, very good. All in favor? Any opposed? Okay, move along. Dawn? Oh no, me. Okay, you switch them around, I guess. I did? Okay. Anyway, but we do have to actually have some discussion tonight. And we're going to move this meeting along a bit for those, and I'm expecting more people, correct, who are going to be speaking tonight? Yeah. But I want to spend a bit of time, obviously, on a very important event, which is next month, October 18th, for our awards dinner. So I'm going to turn this over between Dawn can give us the update, and Gus can also help us out here. And hopefully everyone sitting here at this horseshoe will be in attendance. And so, Dawn, do you want to fill us in where we're at with this?
So again, good evening, welcome. Our awards dinner is going to be on October 18th at 6:30 p.m. and it will be held at the Lombardi's. Our honorees, just for those of you who don't know, and feel free to take a flyer that's located in the middle area of the room. Our keynote speaker is going to be Dr. Brooke Ellison. Our honorees include Astrid Fidelia, Roberta Richin, the Butterfly Effect Project, Laura Lemus, Christina Vargas, and Dr. Katie Janine Mazzi of the Bayshore High School Peer Support Program. And if you recall seeing the flyer, payment is due October 4th, so that is next week. And so presently, I have information for all the commission members so that if you don't recall anything that I'm saying at this moment, you can feel free to take that information with you. But at this particular point, we have approximately 53
Looks like we can't do that in the time.
We have approximately 53 RSVPs. However, one, our guarantee is 80. And when you look at the list, the 53 that we have so far includes the majority of the commission members, which I hope everyone, if you're available, will be able to attend, and your guests. It includes our honorees as well as our performers that we're going to have for the evening. So we definitely need to encourage those who have indicated that they would desire to attend. We would encourage them to RSVP and to make those payments prior to or on October 4th so that we could at least meet our minimum guarantee. And I'm going to actually, because Dr. Mantia is the chair of the awards dinner, I'm going to now turn it over to him for any additional comments.
Very simple comments. It's a great event. I think we honor people in the community who do the things that we ask of ourselves, and they do it without being asked. We have usually a very good turnout. We look forward to seeing all of our constituents there, and most certainly we hope that there'll be a large influx of guests in their positions of being honored. I really don't have much else to say. It takes a lot of work. Dawn does 99% of it. I do about 1%. And she really does a great job. So please accept this as an invitation to come. Thank you.
And for all of us, if we know friends or people, you know, to be a member of the Human Rights Commission or even associate with Human Rights, certainly our keynote speaker should be very inspiring. So there's a lot of reasons. It's a good dinner as well for those for whom they eat to live, right? That's a good meal also. I know some people do the dinner circuit, okay? This is the first time we've ever done it in the fall, and we know the reasons. Unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever, is that it turns out to be that same night, yes, our Youth Enrichment Services of Iceland is having their 30th anniversary dinner celebration. And I don't know how many people from that group, although quite often Mary Ann Pfeiffer has in the past come to our event. So she's one obviously not coming. And some other people from that area from Iceland might be going there rather than us, unfortunately. That's the way it goes. We didn't know that when we made our date, obviously. So please speak it up. And Gus, are we all set with assignments of who's introducing whom and
not
all?
Yet.
Hmm?
Not yet.
Okay, so because we don't have another meeting of our group here before the dinner.
We'll certainly take volunteers if they actually had affiliation, and I think Linda has. Sorry.
Yeah.
But in the past, I think if there was a collaboration to a group that's being honored, we let the commissioner that brought them forward do the introduction. If not, we'll do it the way we've done in the past with you and I doing it.
And also, Gus, congratulations on all these certificates you got.
Oh, thank you.
I know. Incredible.
You got distracted.
Just looking at your name here 10 times.
Thank you.
God bless you. That's great.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions about the awards tonight?
I just like to add one more thing. So if you could pick up the checklist, there's a checklist of things that need to be completed by obviously October 18th, and so this is a good opportunity if you are available to volunteer. That pretty much lays out what we need to be completed and what we can do. Dr. Mantia and I can arrange to have a conference call so that we can make sure that all of the final details are finalized by the time that we need them to be done. So again, please, before you leave, take the checklist and see what way you can help us make sure that this is a very successful program. Thank you.
Where is that checklist?
It's in your folder.
Okay. Okay, so for those of you who have not been before, I think everyone here has, we need people to introduce each one of the recipients and say something about them, and obviously issue to them their awards. We do new clergy, I guess, right? To do nothing to work out. Okay. B, under five, DASA, the Dignity for All Students Act. This comes under actually the work of our subcommittee, the Suffolk County's Anti-Bias Task Force. Last spring, actually right after the election, is that it was brought to our attention a number of incidents that were occurring throughout the county. And as we began to pursue as to how these incidents are particularly bullying, were being handled in school districts, we began to discover that DASA, which is a state-mandated program dealing with bullying in all of the school districts and schools of the state of New York, is being implemented in a very shoddy fashion. There are some school districts which in their own way have actually opted out in a sense, and there's really a failure on the part of some of the school districts to properly notify families that there is a procedure if their child is suffering in school, how to deal with this. And every single school, every single district is supposed to have a DASA representative in the school, one of the teachers. I found out recently that person actually gets an actual additional stipend, sort of like running a club. Well, that's the way it goes. But anyway, that person is designated such, and any act of bullying is supposed to be reported, and there are actually three forms that need to be filled out in terms of interviews. Number one, the perpetrator, the family, the victim, as well as any witnesses. And there needs to be proper follow-through. It's reported to the state of New York in the yearly annual report, yearly annual, obviously, report to the state of these incidents. So the state has some idea of bullying things going on in schools, incidents, as well as there needs to be follow-up when it's appropriate in schools. And we found out that the system has not 100% fallen apart, but in many school districts it certainly has. So it was just wonderful, really, to develop the cooperation between the Anti-Bias Task Force, our commission, as well as BOCES and the Superintendent's Conference of Suffolk County. God bless, I would say, Julie Lutz, who's the COO, I think, of Houston BOCES, an amazing woman, and she and Lars Clemenson, who's the president of the Superintendent's Conference, who's also superintendent in Hampton Bays. They've really taken the lead to put together an exciting, incredible training program for all of the DASA representatives in all 71 school districts of the county on October 27th. It will be at the BOCES Center in Holbrook near Costco. So if you don't know where that center is, you know where Costco is, I'm sure. If you wish to attend, it's basically a training program for the DASA representatives. However, we, the commission members, if we wish to attend, it should be really fascinating. We have five different workshops going on throughout the morning. It's going to be very intense, and I will do this, of course, that morning. Thank BOCES and the Superintendent's Conference for their incredible cooperation. Without them, we could not have done this. But they realize that something is happening. And parenthetically, this is the fifth anniversary of DASA. So it's an appropriate time to be having this kind of updating of what's happening. So that is the 27th, I think it's 9:30 to 1, I think. So if you are interested, let Dawn know, and we'll let Julie and those who are involved in putting this together know who's going to be in attendance. And also for those of you, like I know Carolyn, are involved in Anti-Bias Task Forces, you can let them know that this is happening within their town, and to monitor this as well. I think what we'll do is if we find out, but that's going to be up to Julie, of course, but if we find out that certain school districts are not responding, because they can't be required to attend. BOCES is a voluntary, right, it's a cooperative, is that we might want to put some pressure on some school districts to make sure that they do attend, because probably the ones who aren't attending are the ones who need to be attending, as they say. Okay, any questions about that? So that's really a very exciting project. And a most important one for our county and for our children. So, any questions? Okay, do you want to report?
You'll find a copy of my report in your folders, and there are actually extra copies there in the back room if you're interested in following along. I'm not going to read everything verbatim, but I just wanted to highlight a few things that are on the report. Since we last met in June and July, the commission handled 533 inquiries. We've opened 48 cases, and 38 of those cases included employment discrimination, 3 included housing, 5 included public accommodation. For the month of August, we handled 209 inquiries, of which 30 cases were open, 18 included employment, 7 included housing, 2 included public accommodation, and 2 included police complaints. And just as a reminder to all those who are not aware, we do not investigate complaints regarding the police department and undue force. We only take the information and we forward that information over to IAB. Year to date, our conciliation value is $117,500. And when I say conciliation value, that's not only monetary amounts that are going to the complainants, but it may be the value of what our efforts have accomplished. So in some instances, we'll have someone who came in for a housing issue, and it may have been source of income, and we were able to get that complainant the apartment that they were looking for, although they were initially denied the opportunity to reside in that apartment because of source of income. So just so that we're clear on what the year-to-date conciliation value means. So I am going to pass around the reports from the Suffolk County Police Department, the hate crimes incident reports. It's rather thick, and again, this encompasses everything from July to present. And if you want to take a look, and if you have any questions, I see Detective here, so I don't know if there's anything that you may want to direct to him, but you can take a look at that. And the next thing I just like to point out is that we, over the summer, we were busy working, the commission. On August 1st, I did meet with the Housing for All Coalition, and many of you know we've had communications and conversations with them, and one of the things that we did talk about was the source of income implementation, as well as the commission's outreach and what we've actually been doing in terms of addressing the source of income matters. And we also did speak about whether or not the commission would endorse a statewide source of income law. And so I'm anticipating that there will be a follow-up meeting, and as soon as I get more information, then I will definitely share that with the commission. Next, I did attend the Eastern Suffolk BOCES, their annual strategic planning council meeting. That was the first time that I participated in that program, and it was very interesting because they are looking to do various partnerships, and there was an interest to see what it is that the commission does and how, if any way, we can actually partner with some of the things that they're doing. So I'm looking forward to having future dialogue with them. I think Dr. Lutz, she was the moderator of that program, so I'll be looking forward to see what came out of that meeting and what, if anything, the commission would be partnering with them to do. Some of the upcoming events that we're going to be participating in, on Friday I'll be doing a presentation at the Farmingdale College, the Long Island Educational Opportunity Center, and they're having a roundtable discussion which is entitled How Immigrant Laws Impact Students Transitioning into Higher Education. And so that's going to be on Friday, and I'm looking forward to that presentation, a roundtable, a more intimate discussion with some of the students who attend college. And we're also going to have a representative from our office attend on Friday as well, the Catholic Charities Quarterly Community Meeting, and they're going to give us information on the refugees and the status. And we know with everything that's going on, there's probably going to be a lot to report. So once we gather that information, we'll definitely have a report that we'll share with the commission members. We have the awards dinner on October 18th that we've already spoken about. We'll be presenting at the Ward Melville Patriot Pride Day on October 5th, which is something that we did last year, and we received positive feedback from the young people, and we know that that usually is a really hard crowd to please, but we're happy that we were able to participate, and we actually talked about gender identity and issues when we did that presentation. So we'll probably be speaking upon a similar topic. And then what I've been working on is trying to, because one of our missions is to educate not only the community but also county agencies, and so what I've been able to do is set up various presentations with county agencies. And so in the month of October and November, I'll be doing a presentation with the Department of Labor, with the DSS Constituent Advocacy Council, as well as with DSS Advocate Training. And so I will definitely let the commission know, members know how those presentations are unfold, and we're going to obviously be looking to do more. And that really concludes my report. Are there any questions?
Dawn, on the 26th, October 26th, Department of Labor presentation, 10:30, Building 17, North Garden Complex. Is that what you were speaking about with DSS?
That's actually the Department of Labor.
Only the Department of Labor?
That's only the Department of Labor.
And you're giving a presentation to them?
I am. So that presentation is going to be with supervisors.
May I join you? I don't want to speak. I'd just like to be there with you.
Absolutely. And any of the presentations, thanks, the commission members are definitely welcome to participate. And since Michelle spoke, she refreshed my recollection that her and I actually met. She is the chair of the Employment Committee, and as you all know, when we look at these statistics, employment is the highest number of cases that we handle at the commission, and that's been historically since I think the onset of the commission. And so Michelle approached me because she basically said, we have to do something about these numbers. And so I was amazed at the work that she had done in the past with some of the research of the economic studies that she did and performed on Long Island, Suffolk County specifically. So we are working together to gather that information, and we're hoping to have some type of symposium or conference in the near future. So be on the lookout for that. And as always, we love volunteers. I'm sure Michelle would love to have someone or a few people join her on that committee. So we'll send out future meeting dates just for your information, hopefully your participation.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Michelle. Any other comments about Dawn's report? I think, and I'm glad the presiding officer is here. If any of your colleagues say, what does the Human Rights Commission do? Do we really need them? Well, you can see the statistics speak for themselves, and Dawn's report by itself tells you how very busy we are and what we're able to accomplish. Yeah. Detective, do you have anything you want to add about your unit?
No, sir, I don't have anything to add. If anybody goes through the report for what we did over the summer, I'll be here for the rest of the night. You can always call the office. We'll try and fill in any gaps that you might have. That report is very comprehensive. We over-report, and then we investigate, and then a lot of times it gets we pare it down a little bit to once we get more facts about cases. So something you see on there on its face might seem like one thing, and if you call because you have a question about it, we can explain it out to you and kind of bring it a little clarity. So I think I know most of the people on the panel. If anybody has any questions,
feel free. The only question I had, because I'm the first one reading it, since I got past me first, that there's been a series of swastikas that have been marked up on buildings and what have you. Are they concentrated in particular areas, or is it really countywide?
I don't look at the statistics of everybody, what everybody does. That would be another officer who focuses mainly on that. As far as I know, we don't have a rash of, say, specifically to one area specifically, like Huntington or for Bayshore or anything like that. That hasn't been pointed out to us. We look for those types of things. If there was something that we needed to pay special attention to, it would be brought to our attention. As far as I know, there's nothing specific to any specific place.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Excuse me, Stephen. I'm sorry, I hate to be so rude. I'm going before October 27th, the DASA conference. Here it says it's going to be at the Millikan Center, Edward Millikan Center in Oakdale. And on the on our agenda it says, we said BOCES and Holbrook, which is which? Are there two?
On the 27th?
Yeah.
Oh. What, am I the one then? Okay, I guess we'll change then. Okay, then it's obviously we're doing, I guess we're doing it. We'll have to clarify that, I guess. Maybe earlier on it was in, that's the President Costco. Thank you, Detective. And we always need to stress that if you see something, obviously say something. And there was nothing too minor, okay? Because everything, every single symbol, no matter how small it might be, is offensive to somebody. Just 3 days ago, someone sent me over in Iceland. There was a poster on, this was a tree, I think it was, from a white nationalist supremacist type group, I think called Blood and Soil.org, I think it's right.
And that's their website there. Vanguard America is
where they're going by. I mean, there are things out there that need to be reported, so I sent it to the hate crimes unit, and they already got it from somebody else, because we have this network of anti-biased task forces and a network of people out there who see something. So please, everyone know it's very important, if you see something at all, to say something, to get the information to somebody. It's very important whether an arrest can ever be made, whether someone can be found is another story, but we need to know what's going on in our community so that we can bring together our resources to react or to prevent for the future. So that's always very important. And no matter how heinous the symbol is, do not erase it until the police come. Right, Detective?
That's right, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Next on the agenda is our committee reports. I don't, aside from actually the awards committee, I don't think we have any other reports?
No.
No. So.
From the Administration of Justice Committee, we had anticipated, we met with the police commissioner last year, and we're hoping this year to meet with who will ever be the new sheriff. If we need to follow on that.
Right, good. Okay, so we'll work that out. And also we want to meet with the police commissioner again, but it might be a new commissioner eventually, as time moves along here. Yeah, okay, so we'll work out once the, when is it, that's the November election, right? For the sheriff? Okay. Thank you. Keep on reminding us, Carolyn, okay? Any other committee reports? Old business? Whatever that is, new business? Okay. Yes.
On new business, I kind of debated saying, talking about it or not, and I think I need to bring it to the commission's attention. There's a new recommendation for new regulations regarding workers' compensation in the state of New York. It was not done through the usual process of legislation, it's done backdoor through the budget. And this next week is the last week for comments. And there are a lot of problems in it, but there's one major one that people here may be interested in, that for the first time, when an injured worker goes to see the workers' compensation doctor, they're not going to have to fill out a questionnaire. I've never done that before. Usually you're hurt in the job, you go to the doctor, they see if you're hurt, now the questionnaire. Part of the questionnaire is, the problem with it is, first of all, people don't speak English, may have problems with some of the questions. There's no right to counsel. You can't object to a question. If you don't answer a question, you lose your benefits. And it appears right now there's going to be questions regarding your immigration status, which was never been done before. So I'm just bringing up the issue. If anyone is interested in these issues, see me afterwards all the time. You should make your comments known. It's being done kind of quietly behind the scenes through the budget process. It will affect, and other areas are going to affect the actual payments to workers. It will be sliced almost a quarter of what they're getting now. There will be a lot of power to the doctors who are obviously being paid behind the scenes by insurance companies and the comp board, and it's going to affect injured workers throughout the state. And I just thought, although I know it's not directly in what we do, it will affect a lot of immigrants and people who may not know the process and can be recently hurt. So I wanted to bring it forward, though.
Thank you. Martha, is that in writing that you could send it to, out that one part to everybody?
Yes, well, I could try. There's a lot to it.
Well, the part that you just mentioned, that would be that part. And then, I don't know, is this, like you said, there's going to be public hearings.
Right, well, there's a comment period going on right now. It's only open for another, until next week.
Has it been passed?
Well, again, went through the budget, so it's not like, now there's an open comment period, and that's now. But it's, I think it's up next week. I think we'll have the end of next week to talk. So anyone wants to make a comment about it.
Individually, I guess.
Groups that one. Also, the groups that, a lot of labor groups are speaking out, the groups are also speaking out. Yeah. So I'm just putting out to the public that they should be aware of it and speak out.
So when you say individuals could do, I guess we'd have to really see it before we could take a vote as a commission.
Wasn't asking for a vote, just putting it to
the
people.
No, it's terrible.
Let me know.
Bonnie? Well, if you could get something to us in writing, because I think people want us to actually see it, okay? And then we could possibly do some kind of a collective, we could go have a discussion unless you do a conference call. Or
do it by email.
Email phone, yeah.
Do it quickly,
because we've got to
get it.
Yeah, quickly. So if you could get us as soon, we'll take care of it. So, do I need to know you're going to be away next week, maybe? We'll see. If you can.
Email.
Yeah. All right, wow, there's something happening. Okay, public hearing. Welcome everyone, those of you who are here to speak tonight. We as a commission have taken on the task of, and particularly of late throughout our history, is to make public stands regarding issues that affect us locally, on the state, or even nationally, which we've done at times. Thanks, I would like to say personally, to Carolyn, who has inspired us to make sure that we get something out when things happen. We've been doing that, I think, much better lately. This certainly is evidenced by the press release regarding Charlottesville. We had some frustration in the sense that a number of the organizations that we were all involved with, like ourselves, the Human Rights Commission, Enterprise Task Force, and the Center for Social Justice, really hope to come out with a much broader statement and proposal for a program in the aftermath of Charlottesville, but that just didn't pan out. However, we did have a statement that was published eventually, found its way to the letters to the editor of Eastern Newsday, and certainly what we're doing tonight. So just to say, for those of you who will be speaking tonight, if you do not feel comfortable giving your name, it certainly is fine, you don't have to. But what will be spoken tonight is going to be recorded, as we had done 6 months ago when we did something similar. And we'll take those statements tonight and burn them into a CD and mail them to our county legislators and also representatives on the state and government and Washington and the federal level so that they will hear the voices, your voices, in the hopes that that will be instrumental in dealing with DACA in the way that it should, because one thing is for sure, as all of us should know, and I do believe that every one of us here in this commission knows very, very well, and all of you as well, and that is what affects one person affects everybody, and we are all one, and thereby we stand with you. And so if anyone would like to come to the microphone, you're welcome to. Does anyone want to say anything? Sorry for me talking all the time. Oh, yes. Actually, while you're coming up, Carolyn is going to read the statement that we did make as a commission regarding DACA. Then please come to the microphone.
The Suffolk County Human Rights Commission responds to a decision to end DACA. Suffolk County Human Rights Commission is charged with, quote, fostering mutual respect and understanding among all groups in the community. Fulfilling this charge requires that the Suffolk County Human Rights Commission enforce those human rights laws aimed at ensuring that our community is one in which all human beings can live and work without being under a cloud of fear. Many valued members of our community are forced to live in the shadows with the fear of being targeted for deportation after years of being contributing members of our community, with the fear that their children who have grown up all their lives in this country will be deported to a country they have never known. DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, provided temporary protection to young people who had been brought as children to this country by their parents. The Suffolk County Human Rights Commission acknowledges the significant role that DACA has played since it was issued in 2012 in enabling these young people to come out of the shadows to work, study, and pay taxes. DACA has been rescinded by the Trump administration. The decision to end DACA, or the threat to do so, only contributes to severe life disruptions and the unwarranted criminalization of almost 800,000 young people. Research shows that 91% of this population works and pays taxes, and that 65% have availed themselves of educational opportunities. The recent decision passed responsibility to the Congress to effectuate some more permanent redress of these young people's potentially devastating and unwarranted punishing marginalization. It is the position of the Suffolk County Human Rights Commission that the failure to protect these young people, who have largely only known the United States as their home, is both economically counterproductive and socially destructive. We urge Congress to immediately seek legislative remediation of this tragic and unfair state of affairs.
So, please, if you feel comfortable, to introduce yourself and give your name if you're with an organization, and you have to keep your finger down on the mic. Okay, it's all pleasure.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Walter Barrientos. I am the Long Island Organizing Director for Make the Road New York, and I am joined by two of our members who will share their names and will follow after a quick introduction from me to share their stories and how they connect to these issues. So I'll just pass it on so they can introduce themselves before I say more.
Good evening. My name is Fran Stifoe. I'm a DACA recipient. I was brought to the United States when I was 6 years old. And I've lived here for 17 years. And yeah.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. My name is Rodman Serrano. I live in Bayshore. I am the son of two immigrant parents from El Salvador, both of whom have TPS, program stands for Temporary Protected Status. And it's very similar to DACA, and I'm explaining it, why it's very important to our family.
Thank you both. And so just in case some of you may not be aware, Make the Road New York is a membership-based organization. We serve predominantly immigrants from Latin America, low-income and working-class immigrants throughout the downstate area. We serve them through community centers that are based in some of the most densely populated immigrant neighborhoods. In the city, we run three community centers, one in Staten Island, one in Brooklyn, and one in Queens. And here on Long Island, we run a community center in Brentwood, which is the sort of the hub through which we're able to serve other immigrant communities here on Long Island. We are a membership-based organization, but it just means that we encourage people to become members and become active members of our membership. But in addition to some of what we call survival services, integration services, particularly for recently arrived immigrants, such as English classes, immigration law consultations, and support with citizenship and other basic applications, including DACA, until it was stopped earlier this month. We also provide leadership development and civics education for immigrants to be able to engage in their communities and influence and raise their voices on issues that are important to them. And so Rodman and friends are two perfect examples of the work that we do in immigrant communities and with immigrant youth in particular, to ensure that they're able to share their stories and influence decision makers to change narratives that that are often dehumanizing, as many of you know, and I think you were discussing in the context of the white supremacist agenda that is being implemented by this administration in many different ways. So we're here this evening mostly to talk about DACA and TPS. I should mention that as many of you may be aware, the situation in immigrant communities around the country is a dire one. We are seeing every day through social media and videos all of the different abuses of power by different layers of law enforcement being launched against our communities. And many of those have occurred here in Suffolk County. And I think we could discuss that at another point, but I'm sure you have seen the headlines in the newspapers about teenagers and kids, sometimes 13 or 14 years old, who have now ended up in high security detention centers across the country after being labeled gang members with very weak or no evidence, simply for being unaccompanied minors or recently arrived youth. And that is a dire concern of ours. There was also a father of two kids here from this community here in Suffolk County who died in ICE custody in June after not receiving medications for conditions that ICE was aware that he needed for the long-term health conditions that he was suffering from and that the family and he himself had requested medical care. I don't raise this to scare you more. I raise this to highlight how what we are seeing at the national level is also happening right here in our county, in Suffolk County. And even if the local or regional media may not be covering it, it is happening. And people like us who are working in immigrant communities and working with people like Rodman and France in many of these communities are having to deal with this level of trauma almost on a daily basis. I know I've been in contact with some of you. As some of these other cases have hit your own communities and some of the institutions that you are connected to. And so I just have to say they are not isolated incidents. There are dozens or hundreds of these cases happening here on Long Island. And we really thank you for taking the leadership and the opportunity to hear from us today to know what else can be done and how all of us can continue to work together to advocate and change the narratives that are often misguided by lack of information or plain bias and hatred of people like the three of us in front of you, immigrants from Latin America, who for many can just be confused or labeled as Mexicans or criminals and many different things. I will share that I grew up here in Suffolk County and just on the other side of a block along county line in Amityville. I grew up undocumented here on Long Island while my parents waited 18 years for our immigration application to be processed. And by the time it was processed, I was too old to be included in that application. So if it wasn't for the fact that I was a victim of a crime while attending college in New York City, I would be a dreamer this day. And that is how I actually became involved in the immigrant rights movement as an undocumented student here on Long Island in Suffolk County. And that is why I commit my work to do the work that I do, because in addition to being undocumented when I graduated college, I was also apprehended by immigration and held at a high security prison in upstate New York. And so I know firsthand what it means for immigrants who are trying to find a way to go through our current immigration system to adjust their status, to be treated falsely in prison and traumatized through a process of and being put in deportation proceedings when most of the time people end up deported, which would have been my case if it wasn't for the fact that there was a strong effort by a number of advocacy organizations throughout the state to fight my case. And so I pose this to you because I think, you know, many people will often say, well, you know, we don't have a problem with people like you guys, you know, like you speak English and all of these things. We have a problem with the people who have just come in, who haven't gotten in the line. And I want to pose to all of you that this is a picture of someone who has waited in that line for a long time. And this is what it looks like, despite the pictures and things that we may see in the media and the narratives that people want to put out there about what undocumented families are like and what we are and who we are and what we aspire to do in our communities. So getting into the issue before, I think the most powerful thing will be for you to hear from France, who is a DACA recipient, and from Rodman, who is the son of parents who have TPS. But just to contextualize this issue, in addition to this all-out enforcement mechanism that this administration has launched against immigrant and refugee communities, as we continue to see with the travel bans and a number of other exclusionary measures that this administration is taking, they are also taking aim at all of the other immigrant and refugee populations that still do not have permanent immigration status or a pathway to citizenship in this country. Most notably, DACA, which is the one that's been in the news the most, and the travel bans, but also TPS, which stands for Temporary Protected Status. It is a program that is designed to protect immigrants or refugees who have come into the United States, sometimes with the tourist visa or through the border, fleeing bad conditions in their countries, generally natural disasters like earthquakes and hurricanes, which is the case for most Central Americans who came to Long Island in the 90s, or political turmoil in their countries, like the civil wars. And so I like to explain TPS as a sort of a light version of asylum. So usually people need to prove for asylum that they personally were targeted by some type of political action. And for the people who do not fit that criteria, they generally fit under TPS. People who said my entire neighborhood was devastated by a hurricane or an earthquake, I had to flee because I lost my business, and this is where I had family who could help me and who could help me provide for my family. So that's what TPS is. TPS is, by its very name, it's meant to be temporary, so it means that it provides people, much like DACA, it provides people who fit that criteria from those specific countries reprieve from deportation and a work permit that also allows them to get a social security number, a driver's license, and a job, and that allows them to be basically, in for the purposes of our economy, just like everyone else who is a citizen or a permanent resident, and function in our economy that way. And that is how many, so Long Island is one of the, it's usually somewhere between the top 20, particularly Suffolk, Nassau and Suffolk are among the top 20 counties in the country with the highest numbers of both DACA recipients and TPS recipients. That is because, and the way I like to explain it is that the majority of times parents came here, they had no permanent form of immigration relief, so they applied for TPS. And because their children usually came with them or afterwards, and TPS does not allow people to petition for their children. It's an individual status that you keep for yourself, and you cannot sort of share it in the way that immigration status works. Eventually, many of them had to reunite with their children, and their children were undocumented, and many of their children have DACA. And we have these families that are basically in limbo under the DACA program, now protected from deportation, and usually one or both parents protected from deportation through the TPS program. And Suffolk County is among the top counties of that for a number of reasons, including the economic boom that we were going through in the 90s. So as many of these, particularly Central American refugees were essentially coming to the United States, Long Island provided a very ripe environment economically where we had the demand for manual labor and the industries where immigrants tend to go into, which is domestic work, much like my mom and many of the people that we work with here on Long Island, or construction and landscaping, like most, a lot of immigrant men here on Long Island for Central America. So just to contextualize this, around the country, there are about 400,000 people who have TPS. These includes people predominantly from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, also Haiti most recently because of the earthquakes and the hurricanes in recent years, but also other countries like Sudan and other countries in Africa. We don't have too many immigrants from those countries here on Long Island, but it's definitely in Staten Island, for example, that's what we're seeing. The significant number of TPS recipients are from African countries, particularly who fled during the Ebola crisis and have been here since those communities were destabilized for that. So it's a list of about 12 countries. It includes predominantly El Salvador, which is the country with the largest number of recipients out of all, and the longest receiving. El Salvador has been designated a TPS protected country for about 20 years. So that's precisely the profile of Rodman's parents. Their children have now been born here and are turning 21 in large numbers. So it includes El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, also Haiti, and a number of African countries, including Liberia, and until recently, South Sudan, Sudan, Syria, and a number of other countries. And what we have seen is that, just like we saw with DACA, this administration from early this year began canceling TPS protections for countries. The first country that was renewed by this administration was Haiti. Generally, the procedure is that it goes country by country, so each country has sort of like a day when it's supposed to be renewed. When Haiti came up in February, the administration initially said they were intending not to renew it. After a lot of advocacy, which included many elected officials and Haitian elected officials and leaders, mostly in Nassau County, but you know, significantly also from across the island, it was extended. The administration decided to extend it, not for the 18 months that is the usual period, but only for a year, with a notice from the secretary at the time, I believe it was Secretary Kelly of the Department of Homeland Security, that said that it was being extended for one final year to allow TPS recipients from Haiti to make plans for their return to Haiti. That was in February. Since then, the other countries that they were supposed to renew just about 2 weeks ago were Sudan and South Sudan. They only renewed for one of those countries, and they completely, I believe Sudan is a country that was canceled. Not only was TPS canceled for those families, but now they have also been included in the ban that was announced by the administration this past weekend. So without this, and the renewal dates for El Salvador and Honduras in particular, which is most concerning to us here on Long Island because that's the majority of our TPS population, is coming up in October and November respectively. And we have no reason to believe that this administration will think about these countries any differently than they have been thinking about Haiti or South Sudan, particularly given the fact that El Salvador and Honduras have been the countries that have been receiving this protection for the longest. And one of their arguments is that this was only meant to be temporary relief. So before we go into their stories, I would just say for Suffolk County, for Long Island, we estimate that there are 10 to 20,000 individuals on Long Island who are impacted by TPS from Honduras and El Salvador and in Haiti. And that means that usually it's one of the parents, usually not both. These are homeowners, so it would not only have implications for these families and people like Rodman, but it would also have implications for our municipalities, as many of these homes will begin to be vacated and mortgages will not be paid and cars will be left unpaid and other things will begin to sort of fall out of place. And when it comes to DACA, we have about 7,000 DACA eligible or young people who have DACA here on in Suffolk County, and those are the numbers that we expect to be impacted by this decision of the administration to end the program. Just to close, I would say our proposal, our concern, and our recommendation to the commission will be to, just like you have done on DACA, I think, be very clear that we need the most inclusive forms of legislation at the congressional level, at the federal level, to allow these families to adjust their status. We have seen attempts by this administration to begin to limit the number of people who would eventually be able to legalize into a more permanent form of relief from these programs. So they are limiting, for example, to only people who can prove that they have been employed for a certain number of months or years under either of these statuses, or people who can prove that they never needed to apply for food stamps, or they never needed to apply for any other form of humanitarian or social service emergency aid that all individuals have had access to. And so that is the reason why our advocacy has been focused on ensuring that we pass the most inclusive policies that will not limit people's eligibility for it based on some of these superficial categories, but rather respect that they were eligible for these forms of relief on the merits that they fled some of these situations or they fit other criteria. And I'm happy to share more details about that as we move forward after today, but is there a question?
So in terms of the legislation, obviously Congress would be the focus of our advocacy. In terms of the renewal dates and advocating before those to make sure that they that they don't cancel those countries, to whom would that advocacy be directed?
The advocacy, generally, it is the TPS designation is renewed at the recommendation of the Secretary of Homeland Security. However, because we have not seen any real support from the current Secretary for the TPS program in general, the advocacy has focused on Congress to demand that they finally enact some form of legislative solution for these families before the program continues to be phased out for many of these countries. I would just mention each of these families, every time they renew, they pay a significant amount of money. I believe it's $180 for TPS, and for DACA is $495. In addition to going through the fingerprinting and background checking, that refugees and people with both of these statuses are subject to. So I just share that because there is this notion that people who have these forms of status don't go through enough background checks as a reasoning for why these statuses need to be removed. And there is plenty of background checking that goes on for people who have this status. For many Central Americans in particular, like Rodman's family, they've been going through this for 20 years. And we are saying these families have now grown roots here. These are their homes now. And our communities need to embrace them, and we need to give them the legal status to be able to continue integrating and living their full lives in our communities. So without further ado, I'll just pass it on to friends and Rodman so they can share a little bit more of how their lives would be impacted by these two programs for you all to hear.
Yes, thank you. So, like I said, I came here to the United States when I was 6 years old. I was born in Peru, and my parents came here seeking a new life for me and my sister. When I graduated from high school in 2012 was when Obama implemented DACA. So thankfully for me, I was able to be protected by that, and I was able to get a driver's license and work for the first time, and just feel like a person, and help my parents as well, because my parents are undocumented, and they have been living in the shadows for a very long time. And I was able to help them with the bills. I was able to put myself through some school, and I've just been so grateful for it. And now, when I heard that it was being taken away earlier this month, I was I was devastated, not only for myself, but for the thousands of other DACA recipients that would be affected. And I just know it's a human right to be able to pursue your dreams and to become a professional and to help this country grow, and that's my dream. And now that it's being taken away, there are a few things that the government can do for me and my family because of their anti-immigrant rhetoric. And it's just, the protection is going to end for me. I'm not going to be able to work. I'm not going to be able to go to school because I won't be able to afford it. Neither will my parents. I'll lose my driver's license.
And I'll just be returned to the life that I had known before 2012 for years, and I don't know what would become of me or my parents in this country. I love my country of origin. I'm very proud to be Peruvian. But I don't know Peru the way I know this country. New York, Long Island is my home, and I've been raised here practically, you know, all my life, and that is why it's so important for something to be done for dreamers and like myself. And
good evening, everyone. My name is Rodman Serrano. I was born in Queens, and I moved to Long Island when I was 6 years old. And I moved here with both of my parents, and both of my parents are both immigrants from El Salvador, and they both arrived to this country in the early 1990s, where they were escaping the aftermaths of a deadly civil war and also natural disasters that really, that were very deadly and just ended so many people's lives. And so they came to this country in both of them in the early 1990s, seeking a better future for themselves. They're seeking safety, security, and also a better life for their future children, for me and my two sisters. I love my parents very much. They were able to, you know, support me and my sisters both because of their hard work, because of their love for us. And so when, but for a few years, they were both undocumented. When I was 5 years old, my father was working at a car wash. And the car wash, one day the car wash was raided by immigration agents. And so my dad was detained for a month, and for a few weeks I had no idea where he was, and I remember feeling very, you know, sad. I was crying. It was a nightmare. And then thankfully he was able to come back to us. And I mentioned that story because now that my parents have TPS, they have a temporary protection from deportation, and so it means that for our family, it means that they no longer have to fear so much being captured by immigration agents, you know, at their jobs or driving to work, because TPS to us represents like the only form of protection that we have, and so. This program is also not just very important for us, it's vital for us, but it's also very important for the entire community, because I grew up with other children, whether in school or neighbors, whose parents also have this program. This program helps support and protect thousands of families like mine across Long Island and in Suffolk County from being torn apart. And these are families who have deep roots in this country, who contribute a lot through working, through paying taxes, through owning small businesses. And so this program means so much to all of us. And to think that with the current administration and what they're doing, what they're saying, the messages that they're sending, you know, to immigrants here, it's this, the prospect of us losing TPS seems a lot more likely, and so it's. I'm terrified. I'm afraid, and my parents are afraid because they have no idea what they're going to do, what their future, you know, entails. If they lose this program, how would they support me and my sisters? But we all work, but the financial support that they provide for us is very important. It's what allows us to to continue going to school. I'll be graduating next year from Stony Brook, and I know that none of it would have been possible without my parents, you know, financial and also emotional support. The fact that they're there means so much to us. And so I am extremely grateful for them, and I'm happy that they're still around, because I know that places like El Salvador are not, even though the earthquake has been, that was the reason for TPS to be designated there is over. It doesn't mean that El Salvador is a stable country. There's still lots of violence. There's still lack of like job opportunities. And my parents haven't been back. My mom, she went to El Salvador for the first time this month since she came, and that's over 25 years, I think. Their roots, like their lives, are here. They're Americans. They're like New Yorkers, because their children are here, their lives are here, they work here. They love this country. We all love this country. And so it would be a disaster if this program goes away and if families become separated. And so it's very important, I think, for me as a son of parents with TPS, to use my voice to help raise this issue. And I ask you all to use your voice, your power, to also bring light to what's going on. Thank you.
Thank you both. I would just close by saying that in addition to advocacy at the federal level, our recommendation is also to begin advocating with, and we have already begun to advocate with our state and county officials, to ensure that we also set other policies in place that will create some level of safety and stability for these families. We welcome the executive order that the governor issued about 2 weeks ago, ensuring that immigration status will not be asked or reported by state officials, including state troopers and other agencies across the state, unless it is particularly connected to a criminal investigation, or it is required to determine eligibility for particular services or programs.
Did you know about the thing that Mr. Epstein mentioned with the workers' compensation?
I am not aware of that, but we have a team that works on worker issues, so I'm sure that team and our organization has been working on that. We are also, I would say, just some of the other key policies that I think will be critical for Long Island and for Suffolk County would be ensuring that at the state level, we guarantee access to driver's licenses for immigrants regardless of immigration status. This will ensure that people are able to use other forms of ID, like their passport and other things they use for every other legal process, and other forms of proving residency, like their taxes or pay stubs and other things, to obtain driver's licenses in New York. This was ended, I believe, in 2006 or 7, after 9/11. Under the misguidance that somehow the driver's licenses were the things that allow terrorists to get on the planes. And then there was an attempt to bring licenses back to them. That's how my parents first lost their driver's license when I was growing up here on Long Island. And since then, it has not been considered. There is a bill in the assembly that is pushing for drivers to, like other states, including Connecticut, Maryland, and Chicago, and Illinois, and about 12 other states have already passed those laws in recent years. Maryland, allowing immigrants, regardless of immigration status, to apply for driver's licenses, which is not only for identification, but also for public safety issues, because in places like Long Island, where a car is necessary, people do not stop driving simply because they can't get a driver's license. They just start driving without driver's license or driver education, which is also very dangerous, but it's necessary for many families. So a driver's license legislation is one of the other things that we would encourage the commission to consider issuing a resolution and advocating for without state officials. Also, at the county level, the most helpful and the most useful protection we would need is something that we had been advocating for a long time, and the county executive had taken some measure a few years back, was to limit the cooperation with immigration and customs enforcement, because what's going to happen is, as many of these families begin to phase out of immigration status, they become deportable, which means that anytime they can interact with the police, whether it's through a traffic stop or any kind of other investigation, if they are found to not have immigration status, they will end up in deportation proceedings. Our recommendation has been, like many other jurisdictions around the country, that we set the bar so that the only time that our local police departments are cooperating with immigration are when there is a judicial warrant for against an individual. Not just cooperating in the sense that they, if they find out an individual may or may not have immigration status, that they refer them to immigration, which would become a crisis here on Long Island. So those are the two policy issues that I wanted to bring to you, because we are taking every measure that we can, and we think that the commission should be also aware of other forms of advocating for these families that are now, whose lives are now hanging in the balance, and we see no reason to believe that this administration will take any measure to protect them. Thank you.
Doctor, I have a question that for the longest time has boggled my mind, and maybe you can shed some light. Very often you hear people in the community say that part of the reason why they don't want the immigrant population here is because you're using up resources. And I know what the real answer is to that, but I'm wondering now with TPS, does that give you another layer, or does that give you, in the TPS status, does that give you access to resources that allows people to make that comment? So all I'm saying to you is, it's mind-boggling to me, and I'm saying maybe I'm missing something that I don't know. You seem to be very well. You know, I know Daniel L. Schuler. I've known your organization for a long time. You speak very eloquent, so I wanted just to hear from you. Am I missing something here? Is there some kind of resources that you got to have access to that the rest of us, you know?
No, and I'm happy to share with all of you a report that's been done about the contributions of immigrants across the country that generally says that by and large, immigrants actually contribute more through the taxes that they pay, whether it's sales tax, income tax, property tax, and all the other forms of taxes, than what they receive in direct programs that help them. Generally, because without permanent immigration status, like a green card, TPS recipients and DACA recipients are, for the most part, considered undocumented, in the sense that they are not eligible for the programs that other families are eligible to, including sometimes food stamps and other things. Most immigrants are not eligible for that, and if they are, it's usually more on a humanitarian basis, so it only goes for 30 days. And after that, which we have seen with other with immigrants here in Suffolk County, even when there are health issues that are, you know, like homelessness or other addiction, they can only be covered for 30 days, and then they are sort of released back into the community. And I think they are not eligible for those protections for at least a year. That's my understanding. Sort of those one-time sort of humanitarian access to services. But by and large, immigrants pay a significantly larger portion of their income into sort of the public pool of funds at all levels of government, and receive only a small portion. I believe it's about 30% that they actually have access to. So our general stance is when people say some of those things, it comes from a lot of ignorance and bias, and generally as a way to make an argument for not welcoming immigrants, because the reality is that immigrants actually produce a lot of income, and if not, you can look at the Social Security Administration. If it wasn't for all the younger workers who are immigrants, and young people like Ron, like basically the three of us here, the Social Security Administration would not have enough cash flow to cover the Social Security services of the baby boomer generation.
Well, thank you for the contribution.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
But, you know, I think that I appreciate the question because there's this notion of, like, the welfare, queens and immigrants, and I think that it's a disservice, and I would also say it also creates jobs. If you ask many school districts in the East End what they would do if they lose 30 or 40% of their student body, that means that a lot of teachers who are citizens and native born would not have jobs. Every time there is an immigrant here, it means that more money comes from the federal government for social services and all the other needs of that community. And so there are ways in which our communities, you know, we may not be contributing by, millions or thousands of dollars because we have that amount of wealth, but our work creates capital in our communities, and it creates funding for many services, and we know that that is vastly overseen. I'll give you one example. I met with someone at the Traffic Bureau maybe about 2 years ago. It was right after DACA had been announced. It had been going on for about two years at that point, and we were just sort of talking about trends and demographics, and the person asked me if I had any clue why there might be, they had seen a jump of 4,000 new drivers in Suffolk County in the course of 3 years. And they were asking, do you know anything about why this might be? And I said, have you heard of the DACA program? And they said, no. And I said, you know, that program gives a lot of thousands of young people, many of whom here in Suffolk County, a social security number and a work permit, which is what they need to apply for a driver's license. So I would bet that the majority of those 4,000 drivers that were added to Suffolk County in those first few years of the DACA program were DACA recipients, much like France, because their parents don't have a driver's license. So any parent would rather have one licensed driver at home than not have anyone with a driver's license. And they often became the young people who bought cars under their name. Many of these documented young people are the people through which the families purchased homes. And I would just say for those driver's licenses, that meant that more people in DMV, who are generally citizens, had to have more jobs, because those 4,000 people are now drivers that are being served by motor vehicles and also are purchasing more insurance, which is more business for insurance companies. So it's a trickle effect, and it's not always visible because all of us are not labeling ourselves immigrants everywhere we go or labeling our dollars as immigrant dollars. But that is the trickling effect of immigrant populations, particularly in suburban and rural communities like Suffolk County. And that's the work that we're trying to do to raise more awareness about that.
Thank you very much, Walter. Any other comments? Maybe what we'll do I guess we could do another resolution, simply update the other one. And also, Walter, if you would continue when specific legislation comes up, particularly in the county, if you could let us know as it's moving along, because we don't necessarily, sometimes Dawn will receive this information, and sometimes we don't until it's moving along too far into the process so that we could possibly react in a timely fashion. That would be very helpful, because that's something we can do certainly on the state level as well. On the federal level, we're as frustrated as you. And it's a very frustrating world, to say the least, that we're living in right now, because there seem to be so many things out of our control, except every 2 or 4 years, and then God knows what happens then, right? Thank you very much, and our hearts and prayers go out to all of you. And thanks for sharing tonight. Thank you very much. I do want to, Gus, can you tell us, on September 14th, something special happened?
Well,
I don't know if you talk about, but what happened on September 14th? Don't leave also, I want to just get some phone numbers later, okay? So just say my group
groups. Once a year, REMSCO, which is one of the emergency response groups, honors a position of excellence as an agency of excellence, a provider of excellence, and it goes from locally up to the state. The actual winner this year was the head of trauma surgery over at Stony Brook, Boswinkle, and I was the runner-up to Boswinkle.
Well, for us, you're first place.
Thank you.
I was going to say.
Hey, you're first place. Thank you, Gus. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And my vice chair, yes, Linda, was honored by Bill Boyle for Hispanic Jewish Heritage.
Jewish.
That's right, you told me that. And she also won the award of my synagogue for spending more money than any of my synagogue members in a Judaica shop. So she's still holding the award, spending the most at any given shopping moment. So anyway, for the Hispanic Heritage Month on September 20th, Linda, congratulations to you. But for Linda, we say Mazel Tov. Also, I do want to say, because I noticed, Linda, I think you posted something the other day on Facebook. If you could let us know, or anyone who wants to know, how we could possibly help with what's going on in the horrible situation in Puerto Rico. You don't see a whole lot. At least I don't.
Because they say that, you know, we're in Ireland and they just can't drive up to us. Like,
right.
Anywhere else.
Well, yeah, we did. Yeah.
That's what our president said. But actually, we're actually trying to organize at Stony Brook, both in the hospital and on the main campus, places that people could drop off things that will then be picked up. And I've been on the phone with some of the political folks in town. Will be picked up either through the Red Cross or through one of the other areas.
So it has to get to Stony Brook, is what you're saying?
Well, Stony Brook is the one place I know is going to happen, but like in New York City, they had every fire department open its doors to do that. I don't have that kind of control, but I'm just...
Let us know the drop-off place?
Yeah.
Because I know for Harvey, the Jewish community had certain locations. I mean, really collected a lot of stuff that was shipped, that people rented trucks, safety wheels to bring it down.
Yeah.
I want to add to that also that there's an issue of advocacy that I want to urge everyone to contact your congresspeople, and that is that because of the Jones Act, which was passed in 1920, any ships that deliver or go between Puerto Rico and the States has to be run and owned by an American company, and that means that everything that gets transported to Puerto Rico is like twice or three times as expensive as going to any other islands or any other place. And so this is an outdated and there's no reason why people in Puerto Rico should be exploited in this way. So you should just get on the phone, call your legislators, your congresspeople, and tell them and tell them that the Jones Act is a terrible act and should be rescinded.
And actually, to make matters worse, they import almost 70 to 80% of everything that goes into the island. And it's true. I mean, you want to get a 2-liter bottle of Pepsi, you're going to pay $3 for it there.
Like Hawaii.
Yeah.
It's terrible. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your attention. Please don't forget October. What's the date? 18 for our dinner. Please, everyone here is welcome. And therefore, since that is going to be our monthly October meeting, our next full commission meeting will be November 15th. Watch November, it's not the fourth week of the month, since that would be Thanksgiving week. So, November 15th. So, everyone, be well, peace. God bless you. God bless America. Okay, thanks, everyone.